Down past the empty sconces and paintings of little boats riding foamy, corrugated seas, the door marked 408 slanted inward, revealing a foot of the suite's pale carpet. Sunlight from the living room windows made a long rectangle on the inner wall. "Hey, Mom," Jack said, entering the suite. "You didn't close the door. What's the big—" He was alone in the room. "Idea," he said to the furniture. "Mom?" Disorder seemed to ooze from the tiny room, an overflowing ashtray, a half-full tumbler of water left on the coffee table. This time, Jack promised himself, he would not panic. He turned in a slow circle. Her bedroom door was open, the room itself as dark as the lobby, because Lily had never pulled open the curtains. "Hey, I know you're here," he said, and then walked through her empty bedroom to knock at her bathroom door. No reply. Jack opened this door and saw a pink toothbrush beside the sink, a forlorn hairbrush on the dressing table. Bristles snarled with light hairs. "Laura Deloessian," announced a voice in Jack's mind, and he stepped backward out of the little bathroom. That name stung him. "Oh, not again," he said to himself. "Where'd she go?" Already he was seeing it. He saw it as he went to his own bedroom, saw it as he opened his own door and surveyed his rumpled bed, his flattened knapsack and little stack of paperback books, his socks balled up on top of the dresser. He saw it when he looked into his own bathroom, where towels lay in oriental disarray over the floor, the sides of the tub, and the formica counters. Morgan Sloat, thrusting through the door, grabbing his mother's arms and hauling her downstairs, Jack hurried back into the living room and this time looked behind the couch, yanking her out a side door and pushing her into a car. His eyes beginning to turn yellow, he picked up the telephone and punched 0. "This is, Jack Sawyer, and I'm in, room 408. Did my mother leave any message for me? She was supposed to be here and for some reason, I'll check," said the girl. And Jack clutched the phone for a burning moment before she returned. "No message for 408, sorry." "How about 407? "That's the same slot," the girl told him. "Did she have any visitors in the last half hour or so? Anybody come this morning to see her, I mean?" "That would be reception," the girl said. "I wouldn't know. Do you want me to check for you?" "Please," Jack said. "Oh, I'm happy to have something to do in this morgue," she told him. "Stay on the line." Another burning moment. When she came back to him, it was with no visitors. "Maybe she left a note somewhere in your rooms." "Yes, I'll look," Jack said miserably and hung up. Would the clerk tell the truth? Or would Morgan Sloat have held out a hand with a $20 bill folded like a stamp into his meaty palm? That, too, Jack could see. He dropped himself on the couch, stifling an irrational desire to look under the cushions. Of course, Uncle Morgan could not have come to the rooms and abducted her. He was still in California. But he could have sent other people to do it for him. Those people Speedy had mentioned, the strangers with a foot in each world. Then Jack could stay in the room no longer. He bounced off the couch and went back into the corridor, closing the door after him. When he had gone a few paces down the hall, he twirled around in mid-step, went back and opened the door with his own key. He pushed the door an inch in, and then trotted back toward the elevators. It was always possible that she had gone out without her key, to the shop in the lobby, to the newsstand for a magazine or a paper. Sure, he had not seen her pick up a newspaper since the beginning of summer. All the news she cared about came over an internal radio. Out for a walk, then. Yeah, out exercising and breathing deeply. Or jogging, maybe. Maybe Lily Cavanaugh had suddenly gone in for the 100-yard dash. She'd set up hurdles down on the beach and was in training for the next Olympics. When the elevator deposited him in the lobby, he glanced into the shop, where an elderly blonde woman behind a counter peered at him over the tops of her glasses. Stuffed animals, a tiny pile of thin newspapers, a display rack of flavored chapstick. Leaning out of pockets in a wall stand were People and Us and New Hampshire Magazine. "Sorry," Jack said, and turned away. He found himself staring at the bronze plaque beside a huge, dispirited fern. "Has begun to sicken and must soon die." The woman in the shop cleared her throat. Jack thought that he must have been staring at those words of Daniel Webster's for entire minutes. Yes, the woman said behind him. Sorry, Jack repeated, and pulled himself into the center of the lobby. The hateful clerk lifted an eyebrow, then turned sideways to stare at a deserted staircase. Jack made himself approach the man. Mister, he said when he stood before the desk. The clerk was pretending to try to remember the capital of North Carolina or the principal export of Peru. Mister? The man scowled to himself. He was nearly there. He could not be disturbed. All of this was an act, Jack knew, and he said, I wonder if you can help me. The man decided to look at him after all. Depends on what the help is, sonny. Jack consciously decided to ignore the hidden sneer. Did you see my mother go out a little while ago? What's a little while? Now the sneer was almost visible. Did you see her go out? That's all I'm asking. Afraid she saw you and your sweetheart holding hands out there? God, you're such a creep, Jack startled himself by saying. No, I'm not afraid of that. I'm just wondering if she went out, and if you weren't such a creep, you'd tell me. His face had grown hot, and he realized that his hands were bunched into fists. Well, okay, she went out, the clerk said, drifting away toward the bank of pigeonholes behind him. But you'd better watch your tongue, boy. You'd better apologize to me, fancy little Master Sawyer. I got eyes, too. I know things. You run your mouth and I run my business, Jack said, dredging the phrase up from one of his father's old records. Perhaps it did not quite fit the situation, but it felt right in his mouth, and the clerk blinked satisfactorily. Maybe she's in the gardens, I don't know, the man said gloomily, but Jack was already on his way toward the door. The darling of the drive-ins and queen of the bees was nowhere in the wide gardens before the hotel, Jack saw immediately, and he had known that she would not be in the gardens, for he would have seen her on his way into the hotel. Besides, Lily Cavanaugh did not dawdle through gardens. That suited her as little as did setting up hurdles on the beach. A few cars rolled down Boardwalk Avenue, a gull screeched far overhead, and Jack's heart tightened. The boy pushed his fingers through his hair and looked up and down the bright street. Maybe she'd been curious about Speedy. Maybe she'd wanted to check out this unusual new pal of her son's and had wandered down to the amusement park. But Jack could not see her in Arcadia Fun World any more than he could see her lingering picturesquely in the gardens. He turned in the less familiar direction, toward the town line. Separated from the Alhambra's grounds by a high, thick hedge, the Arcadia Tea and Jam Shop stood first in a row of brightly colored shops. It and New England Drugs were the only shops in the terrace to remain open after Labor Day. Jack hesitated a moment on the cracked sidewalk. A tea shop, much less shoppy, was an unlikely situation for the darling of the drive-ins. But since it was the first place he might expect to find her, he moved across the sidewalk and peered in the window. A woman with piled-up hair sat smoking before a cash register. A waitress in a pink rayon dress leaned against the far wall. Jack saw no customers. Then, at one of the tables near the Alhambra end of the shop, he saw an old woman lifting a cup. Apart from the help, she was alone. Jack watched the old woman delicately replace the cup and the saucer, then fish a cigarette from her bag, and realized with a sickening jolt that she was his mother. An instant later, the impression of age had disappeared. But he could remember it. And it was as if he were seeing her through bifocals, seeing both Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer and that fragile old woman in the same body. Jack gently opened the door, but still he sent off the tinkle of the bell that he had known was above it. The blonde woman at the register nodded, smiling. The waitress straightened up and smoothed the lap of her dress. His mother stared at him with what looked like genuine surprise, and then gave him an open smile. "Well, wandering Jack, you are so tall that you look just like your father when you came through that door," she said. "Sometimes I forget you're only 12." "You called me Wandering Jack," he said, pulling a chair out and dropping himself into it. Her face was very pale, and the smudges beneath her eyes looked almost like bruises. "Didn't your father call you that? I just happened to think of it. You've been on the move all morning." "He called me Wandering Jack?" "Something like that, sure he did. When you were tiny. Traveling Jack," she said firmly. "That was it. He used to call you Traveling Jack. You know, when we'd see you tearing down the lawn. It was funny, I guess. I left the door open, by the way. Didn't know if you remembered to take your key with you." "I saw," he said, still tingling with the new information she had so casually given him. "Want any breakfast? I just couldn't take the thought of eating another meal in that hotel." The waitress had appeared beside them. "Young man," she asked, lifting her order pad. "How did you know I'd find you here?" "Where else is there to go?" his mother reasonably asked, and told the waitress, "Give him the 3-star breakfast. He's growing about an inch a day." Jack leaned against the back of his chair. How could he begin this? His mother glanced at him curiously, and he began. He had to begin. Now. "Mom, if I had to go away for a while, would you be all right?" "What do you mean, all right? And what do you mean, go away for a while?" "Would you be able... would you have trouble from Uncle Morgan?"
"I can handle old Sloat," she said, smiling tautly. "I can handle him for a while, anyway. What's this all about, Jackie? You're not going anywhere."
"I have to," he said. "Honest." Then he realized that he sounded like a child begging for a toy. Mercifully, the waitress arrived with toast in a rack and a stubby glass of tomato juice. He looked away for a moment, and when he looked back, his mother was spreading jam from one of the pots on the table over a triangular section of toast. "I have to go," he said. His mother handed him the toast. Her face moved with a thought, but she said nothing.
"You might not see me for a while, Mom," he said. "I'm going to try to help you. That's why I have to go."
"Help me?" she asked, and her cool incredulity, Jack reckoned, was about 75% genuine.
"I want to try to save your life," he said.
"Is that all?"
"I can do it."
"You can save my life. That's very entertaining, Jackie boy. It ought to make prime time someday. Ever think about going into network programming?" She had put down the red-smeared knife and was widening her eyes in mockery. But beneath the deliberate incomprehension, he saw two things. A flare-up of her terror, a faint, almost unrecognized hope that he might, after all, be able to do something.
"Even if you say I can't try, I'm going to do it anyhow. So you might as well give me your permission."
"Oh, that's a wonderful deal, especially since I don't have any idea of what you're talking about."
"I think you do, though. I think you do have some idea, Mom, because Dad would have known exactly what I'm talking about."
Her cheeks reddened, her mouth thinned into a line.
"That's so unfair, it's despicable, Jackie. You can't use what Philip might have known as a weapon against me."
"What he did know, not what he might have known."
"You're talking total horseshit, sonny boy."
The waitress, setting a plate of scrambled eggs, home fries, and sausages before Jack, audibly inhaled. After the waitress had paraded off, his mother shrugged.
"I don't seem to be able to find the right tone with the help around here. But horseshit is still horseshit is still horseshit," to quote Gertrude Stein.
"I'm going to save your life, Mom," he repeated, "and I have to go a long way away and bring something back to do it, and so that's what I'm going to do."
"I wish I knew what you were talking about."
"Just an ordinary conversation," Jack told himself, "as ordinary as asking permission to spend a couple of nights at a friend's house." He cut a sausage in half and popped one of the pieces in his mouth. She was watching him carefully. Sausage chewed and swallowed, Jack inserted a forkful of egg into his mouth. Speedy's bottle lumped like a rock against his backside.
"I also wish you'd act as though you could hear the little remarks I send your way, as obtuse as they may be."
Jack stolidly swallowed the eggs and inserted a salty wad of the crisp potatoes into his mouth. Lily put her hands in her lap. The longer he said nothing, the more she would listen when he did talk. He pretended to concentrate on his breakfast. Sausage, potatoes, eggs, sausage, until he sensed that she was near to shouting at him.
My father called me Traveling Jack, he thought to himself. This is right. This is as right as I'll ever get. Jack? Mom, he said. Sometimes didn't Dad call you up from a long way away, and you knew he was supposed to be in town? She raised her eyebrows. And sometimes didn't you, walk into a room because you thought he was there, maybe even knew he was there, but he wasn't? Let her chew on that. No, she said. Both of them let the denial fade away. Almost never. Mom, it even happened to me, Jack said. There was always an explanation. You know there was. My father, this is what you know, was never too bad at explaining things, especially the stuff that really couldn't be explained. He was very good at that. That's part of the reason he was such a good agent. Now she was silent again. Well, I know where he went, Jack said. I've been there already. I was there this morning. And if I go there again, I can try to save your life. My life doesn't need you to save it. It doesn't need anyone to save it, his mother hissed. Jack looked down at his devastated plate and muttered something. What was that? She drilled at him. I think it does, I said. He met her eyes with his own. Suppose I ask how you propose to go about saving my life, as you put it. I can't answer, because I don't really understand it yet. Mom, I'm not in school anyhow. Give me a chance. I might only be gone a week or so. She raised her eyebrows. It could be longer, he admitted. I think you're nuts, she said. But he saw that part of her wanted to believe him, and her next words proved it. If I were mad enough to allow you to go off on this mysterious errand, I'd have to be sure that you wouldn't be in any danger. Dad always came back, Jack pointed out. I'd rather risk my life than yours, she said. And this truth, too, lay hugely between them for a long moment. I'll call when I can. But don't get too worried if a couple of weeks go by without my calling. I'll come back, too, just like Dad always did. This whole thing is nuts, she said, me included. How are you going to get to this place you have to go to? And where is it? Do you have enough money? I have everything I need, he said, hoping that she would not press him on the first two questions. The silence stretched out, and finally he said, I guess I'll mainly walk. I can't talk about it much, Mom. Traveling Jack, she said. I can almost believe... Yes, Jack said. Yes. He was nodding. And maybe, he thought, you know some of what she knows, the real queen. And that's why you're letting me go this easily. That's right. I can believe, too. That's what makes it right. Well, since you say you'll go no matter what I say, I will, too. Then I guess it doesn't matter what I say. She looked at him bravely. It does matter, though. I know. I want you to get back here as quick as you can, sonny boy. You're not going right away, are you? I have to. He inhaled deeply. Yes, I am going right away. As soon as I leave you. I could almost believe in this rigmarole. You're Phil Sawyer's son, all right. You haven't found a girl somewhere in this place, have you? She looked at him very sharply. No, no girl. Okay, save my life. Off with you. She shook her head, and he thought he saw an extra brightness in her eyes. If you're going to leave, get out of here, Jackie. Call me tomorrow. If I can. He stood up. If you can, of course, forgive me. She looked down at nothing, and he saw that her eyes were unfocused. Red dots burned in the middle of her cheeks. Jack leaned over and kissed her, but she just waved him away. The waitress stared at the two of them as if they were performing a play. Despite what his mother had just said, Jack thought that he had brought the level of her disbelief down to something like 50%, which meant that she no longer knew what to believe. She focused on him for a moment, and he saw that hectic brightness blazing in her eyes again. Anger, tears. Take care, she said, and signaled the waitress. I love you, Jack said. never get off on a line like that.
Now she was almost smiling.
Get traveling, Jack. Get going before I realize how crazy this is. I'm gone, he said, and turned away and marched out of the restaurant. His head felt tight, as if the bones in his skull had just grown too large for their covering of flesh. The empty yellow sunlight attacked his eyes.
Jack heard the door of the Arcadia Tea and Jam shop banging shut an instant after the little bell had sounded. He blinked, ran across Boardwalk Avenue without looking for cars. When he reached the pavement on the other side, he realized that he would have to go back to their suite for some clothes. His mother had still not emerged from the tea shop by the time Jack was pulling open the hotel's great front door. The desk clerk stepped backward and sullenly stared. Jack felt some sort of emotion steaming off the man, but for a second he could not remember why the clerk should react so strongly to the sight of him. The conversation with his mother, actually much shorter than he had imagined it would be, seemed to have lasted for days. On the other side of the vast gulf of time he'd spent in the tea and jam shop, he had called the clerk a creep. Should he apologize? He no longer actually remembered what had caused him to flare up at the clerk. His mother had agreed to his going. She had given him permission to take his journey. And as he walked through the crossfire of the desk man's glare, he finally understood why. He had not mentioned the talisman, not explicitly. But even if he had, if he had spoken of the most lunatic aspect of his mission, she would have accepted that, too. And if he'd said that he was going to bring back a foot-long butterfly and roast it in the oven, she'd have agreed to eat roast butterfly. It would have been an ironic but a real agreement. In part, this showed the depth of her fear, that she would grasp at such straws. But she would grasp because at some level she knew that these were bricks, not straws. His mother had given him permission to go because somewhere inside her she too knew about the territories. Did she ever wake up in the night with that name, Laura Deloessian, sounding in her mind? Up in 407 and 408, he tossed clothes into his knapsack almost randomly. If his fingers found it in a drawer and it was not too large, in it went. Shirts, socks, a sweater, jockey shorts. Jack tightly rolled up a pair of tan jeans and forced them in, too. Then he realized that the pack had become uncomfortably heavy and pulled out most of the shirts and socks. The sweater, too, came out. At the last minute, he remembered his toothbrush. Then he slid the straps over his shoulders and felt the pull of the weight on his back. Not too heavy. He could walk all day, carrying only these few pounds. Jack simply stood quiet in the suite's living room a moment, feeling, unexpectedly powerfully, the absence of any person or thing to whom he could say goodbye. His mother would not return to the suite until she could be sure he was gone. If she saw him now, she'd order him to stay. He could not say goodbye to these three rooms as he could to a house he had loved. Hotel rooms accepted departures emotionlessly. In the end, he went to the telephone pad printed with a drawing of the hotel on eggshell-thin paper, and with the Alhambra's blunt, narrow pencil, wrote the three lines that were most of what he had to say. Thanks. I love you, and will be back. Jack moved down Boardwalk Avenue in the thin northern sun, wondering where he should flip. That was the word for it. And should he see Speedy once more before he flipped into the territories? He almost had to talk to Speedy once more, because he knew so little about where he was going, whom he might meet, what he was looking for. She looked just like a crystal ball. Was that all the instruction Speedy intended to give him about the talisman? That and the warning not to drop it? Jack felt almost sick with lack of preparation, as if he had to take a final exam in a course he'd never attended. He also felt that he could flip right where he stood. He was that impatient to begin, to get started, to move. He had to be in the territories again, he suddenly understood. In the welter of his emotions and longings, that thread brightly shone. He wanted to breathe that air. He hungered for it. The territories, the long plains and ranges of low mountains called him, the fields of tall grass and the streams that flashed through them.
Jack's entire body yearned for that landscape. And he might have taken the bottle out of his pocket and forced a mouthful of the awful juice down his throat on the spot if he had not just then seen the bottle's former owner tucked up against a tree, butt on heels and hands laced across his knees. A brown grocery bag lay beside him, and atop the bag was an enormous sandwich of what looked like liver, sausage, and onion.
"You're moving now," Speedy said, smiling up at him. "You're on your way, I see. Say your goodbyes. Your mama know you won't be home for a while."
Jack nodded, and Speedy held up the sandwich.
"You hungry? This one is too much for me."
"I had something to eat," the boy said. "I'm glad I can say goodbye to you."
"Oh, Jack on fire! He's raring to go," Speedy said, cocking his long head sideways. "Boy gonna move."
"Speedy?"
"But don't take off without a few little things I brought for you. I got 'em here in this bag. You wanna see?"
"Speedy?" The man squinted up at Jack from the base of the tree. "Did you know that my father used to call me Traveling Jack?"
"Oh, I probably heard that somewhere," Speedy said, grinning at him. "Come over here and see what I brought you. Plus, I have to tell you where to go first, don't I?"
Relieved, Jack walked across the sidewalk to Speedy's tree. The old man set his sandwich in his lap and fished the bag closer to him.
"Merry Christmas," Speedy said, and brought forth a tall, battered old paperback book.
It was, Jack saw, an old Rand McNally road atlas.
"Thanks," Jack said, taking the book from Speedy's outstretched hands. "Ain't no maps over there, so you stick as much as you can to the roads in old Rand McNally. That way you'll get where you're going."
"Okay," Jack said, and slipped out of the knapsack so that he could slide the big book down inside it.
"The next thing don't have to go in that fancy rig you carrying on your back," Speedy said.
He put the sandwich on the flat paper bag and stood up all in one long, smooth motion.
"No, you can carry this right in your pocket."
He dipped his fingers into the left pocket of his work shirt. What emerged, clamped between his second and third fingers like one of Lily's Terry tunes, was a white triangular object it took the boy a moment to recognize as a guitar pick.
"You take this and keep it. You'll want to show it to a man. He'll help you."
Jack turned the pick over in his fingers. He had never seen one like it, of ivory, with scrimshaw filigrees and patterns winding around it in slanted lines like some kind of unearthly writing. Beautiful in the abstract, it was almost too heavy to be a useful finger pick.
"Who's the man?" Jack asked. He slipped the pick into one of his pants pockets.
"Big scar on his face. You'll see him pretty soon after you land in the territories. He's a guard. Fact is, he's a captain of the outer guards, and he'll take you to a place where you can see a lady you has to see. Well, a lady you ought to see. So you know the other reason you're putting your neck on the line. My friend over there, he'll understand what you're doing, and he'll figure out a way to get you to the lady."
"This lady..." Jack began.
"Yep," Speedy said, "you got it."
"She's the queen."
"You take a good look at her, Jack. You see what you see when you sees her. You see what she is, understand? Then you head out for the west."
Speedy stood, examining him gravely, almost as if he were just now doubting that he'd ever see Jack Sawyer again. And then the lines in his face twitched, and he said,
"Steer clear of old Bloat. Watch for his trail, his own and his twinner's. Old Bloat can find out where you went if you're not careful, and if he finds out, he's gonna be after you like a fox after a goose."
Speedy shoved his hands in his pockets and regarded Jack again, looking very much as though he wished he could think of more to say.
"Get the talisman, son," he concluded. "Get it and bring it back safe. It gonna be your burden, but you got to be bigger than your burden."
Jack was concentrating so hard on what Speedy was telling him that he squinted into the man's seamed face. Scarred man, captain of the outer guards, the queen, Morgan Sloat, after him like a predator, in an evil place over on the other side of the country. A burden.
"Okay," he said, wishing suddenly that he were back in the tea and jam shop with his mother. Speedy smiled jaggedly, warmly. "Yeah, Bob, old Traveling Jack is okey-doke." The smile deepened. "About time for you to sip at that special juice, wouldn't you say?"
"I guess it is," Jack said. He tugged the dark bottle out of his hip pocket and unscrewed the cap. He looked back up at Speedy, whose pale eyes stabbed into his own.
"Speedy'll help you when he can."
Jack nodded, blinked, and raised the neck of the bottle to his mouth. The sweetly rotten odor which leaped out of the bottle nearly made his throat close itself in an involuntary spasm. He tipped the bottle up, and the taste of the odor invaded his mouth. His stomach clenched. He swallowed, and rough, burning liquid spilled down his throat. Long seconds before Jack opened his eyes, he knew from the richness and clarity of the smells about him that he had flipped into the territories. Horses, grass, a dizzying scent of raw meat, dust, the clear air itself. Interlude. Sloat in This World, 1.
"I know I work too hard," Morgan Sloat told his son Richard that evening.
They were speaking on the telephone, Richard standing at the communal telephone in the downstairs corridor of his dormitory, his father sitting at his desk on the top floor of one of Sawyer and Sloat's first and sweetest real estate deals in Beverly Hills.
"But I tell you, kid, there are a lot of times when you have to do something yourself to get it done right, especially when my late partner's family is involved. It's just a short trip, I hope. Probably I'll get everything nailed down out there in goddamn New Hampshire in less than a week. I'll give you another call when it's all over. Maybe we'll go railroading in California, just like the old days. There'll be justice yet. Trust your old man."
The deal for the building had been particularly sweet because of Sloat's willingness to do things himself. After he and Sawyer had negotiated the purchase of a short-term lease, then, after a gunfire of lawsuits, a long-term lease, they had fixed their rental rates at so much per square foot, done the necessary alterations, and advertised for new tenants. The only holdover tenant was the Chinese restaurant on the ground floor, dribbling in rent at about a third of what the space was worth. Sloat had tried reasonable discussions with the Chinese, but when they saw that he was trying to talk them into paying more rent, they suddenly lost the ability to speak or understand English. Sloat's attempts at negotiation limped along for a few days, and then he happened to see one of the kitchen help carrying a bucket of grease out through the back door of the kitchen. Feeling better already, Sloat followed the man into a dark, narrow cul-de-sac and watched him tip the grease into a garbage can. He needed no more than that. A day later, a chain-link fence separated the cul-de-sac from the restaurant. Yet another day later, a health department inspector served the Chinese with a complaint and a summons. Now the kitchen help had to take all their refuse, grease included, out through the dining area and down a chain-link dog run Sloat had constructed alongside the restaurant. Business fell off. The customers caught odd, unpleasant odors from the nearby garbage. The owners rediscovered the English language and volunteered to double their monthly payment. Sloat responded with a grateful-sounding speech that said nothing. And that night, having primed himself with three large martinis, Sloat drove from his house to the restaurant and took a baseball bat from the trunk of his car and smashed in the long window, which had once given a pleasant view of the street, but now looked out at a corridor of fencing which ended in a huddle of metal bins. He had done those things, but he hadn't exactly been Sloat when he did them. The next morning, the Chinese requested another meeting and this time offered to quadruple their payment.
"Now you're talking like men," Sloat told the stony-faced Chinese. "And I'll tell you what, just to prove we're all on the same team, we'll pay half the cost of replacing your window."
Within 9 months of Sawyer and Sloat's taking possession of the building, all the rents had increased significantly, and the initial cost and profit projections had begun to look wildly pessimistic. By now, this building was one of Sawyer and Sloat's more modest ventures, but Morgan Sloat was as proud of it as of the massive new structures they had put up downtown. Just walking past the place where he'd put up the fence as he came into work in the morning reminded him, daily, of how much he had contributed to Sawyer and Sloat, how reasonable were his claims. This sense of the justice of his ultimate desires kindled within him as he spoke to Richard. After all, it was for Richard that he wanted to take over Phil Sawyer's share of the company. Richard was, in a sense, his immortality. His son would be able to go to the best business schools and then pick up a law degree before he came into the company, and thus fully armed, Richard Sloat would carry all the complex and delicate machinery of Sawyer and Sloat into the next century. The boy's ridiculous ambition to become a chemist could not long survive his father's determination to murder it. Richard was smart enough to see that what his father did was a hell of a lot more interesting, not to mention vastly more remunerative, than working with a test tube over a Bunsen burner. That research chemist stuff would fade away pretty quickly once the boy had a glimpse of the real world. And if Richard was concerned about being fair to Jack Sawyer, he could be made to understand that $50,000 a year and a guaranteed college education was not only fair but magnanimous, princely. Who could say that Jack wanted any part of the business anyhow, or that he would possess any talent for it? Besides, accidents happened. Who could even say that Jack Sawyer would live to see 20? "Well, it's really a matter of getting all the papers, all the ownership stuff, finally straight," Sloat told his son. "Lily's been hiding out from me for too long. Her brain is strictly cottage cheese by now, take my word for it. She probably has less than a year to live. So if I don't hump myself off to see her now that I have her pinned down, she could stall long enough to put everything into probate, or into a trust fund, and I don't think your friend's mama would let me administer it. Hey, I don't want to bore you with my troubles. I just wanted to tell you that I won't be home for a few days in case you call. Send me a letter or something. And remember about the train, okay? We got to do that again." The boy promised to write, to work hard, to not worry about his father or Lily Cavanaugh or Jack. And sometime when this obedient son was, say, in his senior year at Stanford or Yale, Sloat would introduce him to the territories. Richard would be 6 or 7 years younger than he had been himself when Phil Sawyer, cheerfully crack-brained on grass in their first little North Hollywood office, had first puzzled, then infuriated because Sloat had been certain Phil was laughing at him, then intrigued his partner, for surely Phil was too stoned to have invented all this science fiction crapola about another world. And when Richard saw the territories, that would be it. If he had not already done it by himself, they'd change his mind for him. Even a small peek into the territories shook your confidence in the omniscience of scientists. Sloat ran the palm of his hand over the shiny top of his head, then luxuriantly fingered his mustache. The sound of his son's voice had obscurely, irrelevantly comforted him. As long as there was Richard politely coming along behind him, all was well, and all was well, and all manner of things was well. It was night already in Springfield, Illinois, and in Nelson House Thayer School, Richard Sloat was padding down a green corridor back to his desk, perhaps thinking of the good times they'd had and would have again aboard Morgan's toy train line in coastal California. He'd be asleep by the time his father's jet punished the resistant air far above and some 100 miles farther north. But Morgan Sloat would push aside the panel over his first-class window and peer down, hoping for moonlight and a parting of the clouds. He wanted to go home immediately. Home was only 30 minutes away from the office, so that he could change clothes and get something to eat, maybe snort a little coke before he had to get to the airport. But instead, he had to pound out along the freeway to the marina, an appointment with a client who had freaked out and was on the verge of being dumped from a picture, then a meeting with a crowd of spoilers who claimed that a Sawyer and Sloat project just up from Marina Del Rey was polluting the beach, things that could not be postponed. Though Sloat promised himself that as soon as he had taken care of Lily Cavanaugh and her boy, he was going to begin dropping clients from his list. He had much bigger fish to fry now. Now there were whole worlds to broker, and his piece of the action would be no mere 10%. Looking back on it, Sloat wasn't sure how he had tolerated Phil Sawyer for as long as he had. His partner had never played to win, not seriously. He had been encumbered by sentimental notions of loyalty and honor, corrupted by the stuff you told kids to get them halfway civilized before you finally tore the blindfold off their eyes. Mundane as it might be in light of the stakes he now played for, he could not forget that the Sawyers owed him, all right. Indigestion flowered in his chest like a heart attack at the thought of how much, and before he reached his car in the still sunny lot beside the building, he shoved his hand into his jacket pocket and fished out a crumpled package of Digel. Phil Sawyer had underestimated him, and that still rankled, because Phil had thought of him as a sort of trained rattlesnake to be let out of his cage only under controlled circumstances, so had others. The lot attendant, a hillbilly in a broken cowboy hat, eyed him as he marched around his little car looking for dents and dings. The Digel melted most of the fiery ball in his chest. Sloat felt his collar growing clammy with sweat. The attendant knew better than to try to buddy up. Sloat had verbally peeled the man's hide weeks ago after discovering a tiny wrinkle in the BMW's door. In the midst of his rant, he had seen violence begin to darken in the hillbilly's green eyes, and a sudden upsurge of joy had made him waddle in toward the man, still cutting off skin, almost hoping that the attendant would take a poke at him. Abruptly, the hillbilly had lost his momentum, feebly, indeed apologetically, suggested that maybe that there little nothing of a ding came from somewhere else, parking service at a restaurant, maybe, the way those bozos treat cars, you know, and the light ain't so good that time of night. Why, shut your stinking mouth! Sloat had said. That little nothing, as you call it, is going to cost me about twice what you make in a week. I should fire you right now, cowpoke, and the only reason I'm not going to is that there's about a 2% chance you might be right. When I came out of Chasen's last night, maybe I didn't look under the door handle, maybe I did and maybe I didn't, but if you ever talk to me again, if you ever say any more than hello, Mr. Sloat, or goodbye, Mr. Sloat, I'll get you fired so fast you'll think you were beheaded. So the hillbilly watched him inspect his car, knowing that if Sloat found any imperfections in the car's finish, he would bring down the axe, afraid even to come close enough to utter the ritual goodbye. Sometimes from the window that overlooked the parking lot, Sloat had seen the attendant furiously wiping some flaw, bird dropping, or splash of mud off the BMW's hood. And that's management, buddy. When he pulled out of the lot, he checked the rearview mirror and saw on the hillbilly's face an expression very like the last one Phil Sawyer had worn in the final seconds of his life, out in the middle of nowhere in Utah. He smiled all the way to the freeway on-ramp. Philip Sawyer had underestimated Morgan Sloat from the time of their first meeting, when they were freshmen at Yale. It could have been, Sloat reflected, that he had been easy to underestimate. A pudgy 18-year-old from Akron, graceless, overweighted with anxieties and ambitions, out of Ohio for the first time in his life. Listening to his classmates talk easily about New York, about 21 and the Stork Club, about seeing Brubeck at Basin Street and Errol Garner at the Vanguard, he'd sweated to hide his ignorance. "I really like the downtown part," he'd thrown in, as casually as he could. Palms wet, cramped by curled-in fingers, morning Sloat often found his palms tattooed with dented bruises left by his fingernails. "What downtown part, Morgan?" Tom Woodbine had asked him. The others cackled. "You know, Broadway and the Village around there." More cackles, harsher. He'd been unattractive and badly dressed. His wardrobe consisted of two suits, both charcoal gray and both apparently made for a man with a scarecrow's shoulders. He had begun losing his hair in high school, and pink scalp showed through his short, flattened-down haircuts. No, no beauty had Sloat been, and that had been part of it. The others made him feel like a clenched fist. Those morning bruises were shadowy little photographs of his soul. The others, all interested in the theater, like himself and Sawyer, possessed good profiles, flat stomachs, easy, careless manners. Sprawled across the lounge chairs of their suite in Davenport, while Sloat, in a haze of perspiration, stood, that he might not wrinkle his suit pants and thereby get a few more days' wear out of them, they sometimes resembled a gathering of young gods, cashmere sweaters draped over their shoulders like the golden fleece. They were on their way to becoming actors, playwrights, songwriters. Sloat had seen himself as a director, entangling them all in a net of complications and designs which only he could unwind.
Sawyer and Tom Woodbine, both of whom seemed unimaginably rich to Sloat, were roommates. Woodbine had only a lukewarm interest in theater and hung around their undergraduate drama workshop because Phil did. Another gilded private school boy, Thomas Woodbine differed from the others because of his absolute seriousness and straightforwardness. He intended to become a lawyer and already seemed to have the probity and impartiality of a judge. In fact, most of Woodbine's acquaintances imagined that he would wind up on the Supreme Court, much to the embarrassment of the boy himself. Woodbine was without ambition, in Sloat's terms, being interested far more in living rightly than in living well. Of course, he had everything, and what he by some accident lacked, other people were quick to give him. How could he, so spoiled by nature and friendships, be ambitious? Sloat almost unconsciously detested Woodbine, and could not bring himself to call him Tommy. Sloat directed two plays during his 4 years at Yale, No Exit, which the student paper called A Furious Confusion, and Volpone. This was described as churning, cynical, sinister, and almost unbelievably messy. Sloat was held responsible for most of these qualities. Perhaps he was not a director after all, his vision too intense and crowded. His ambitions did not lessen, they merely shifted. If he was not eventually to be behind the camera, he could be behind the people in front of it. Phil Sawyer had also begun to think this way. Phil had never been certain where his love of theater might take him, and thought he might have a talent for representing actors and writers. "Let's go to Los Angeles and start an agency," Phil said to him in their senior year. "It's nutty as hell, and our parents will hate it, but maybe we'll make it work. So we starve for a couple of years." Phil Sawyer, Sloat had learned since their freshman year, was not rich after all. He just looked rich. "And when we can afford him, we'll get Tommy to be our lawyer. He'll be out of law school by then." "Sure, okay," Sloat had said, thinking that he could stop that one when the time came. "What should we call ourselves?" "Anything you like. Sloat and Sawyer? Or should we stick to the alphabet?" "Sawyer and Sloat. Sure. That's great, alphabetical order," Sloat said, seething, because he imagined that his partner had euchred him into forever suggesting that he was somehow secondary to Sawyer. Both sets of parents did hate the idea, as Phil had predicted, but the partners in the Infant Talent Agency drove to Los Angeles and the old DeSoto, Morgan's, another demonstration of how much Sawyer owed him, set up an office in a North Hollywood building with a happy population of rats and fleas, and started hanging around the clubs, passing out their spandy new business cards. Nothing. Nearly 4 months of total failure. They had a comic who got too drunk to be funny, a writer who couldn't write, a stripper who insisted on being paid in cash so that she could stiff her agents. And then, late one afternoon, high on marijuana and whiskey, Phil Sawyer had gigglingly told Sloat about the territories. "You know what I can do, you ambitious so-and-so? Oh, can I travel, partner, all the way?" Shortly after that, both of them traveling now, Phil Sawyer met a rising young actress at a studio party, and within an hour had their first important client. And she had three friends similarly unhappy with their agents, and one of the friends had a boyfriend who had actually written a decent film script and needed an agent, and the boyfriend had a boyfriend. Before their third year was over, they had a new office, new apartments, a slice of the Hollywood pie. The territories, in a fashion that Sloat accepted but never understood, had blessed them. Sawyer dealt with the clients, Sloat with the money, the investments, the business side of the agency. Sawyer spent money, lunches, airplane tickets. Sloat saved it, which was all the justification he needed to skim a little of the cream off the top. And it was Sloat who kept pushing them into new areas, land development, real estate, production deals. By the time Tommy Woodbine arrived in Los Angeles, Sawyer and Sloat was a $5 million business. Sloat discovered that he still detested his old classmate. Tommy Woodbine had put on 30 pounds and looked and acted in his blue three-piece suits more than ever like a judge. His cheeks were always slightly flushed, alcoholic, Sloat wondered, his manner still kindly and ponderous. The world had left its marks on him, clever little wrinkles at the corners of his eyes, the eyes themselves infinitely more guarded than those of the gilded boy at Yale. Sloat understood almost at once, and knew that Phil Sawyer would never see it unless he were told, that Tommy Woodbine lived with an enormous secret. Whatever the gilded boy might have been, Tommy was now a homosexual. Probably he'd call himself gay. And that made everything easier. In the end, it even made it easier to get rid of Tommy. Because queers are always getting killed, aren't they? And did anybody really want a 210-pound pansy responsible for bringing up a teenage boy? You could say that Sloat was just saving Phil Sawyer from the posthumous consequences of a serious lapse of judgment. If Sawyer had made Sloat the executor of his estate and the guardian of his son, there would have been no problems. As it was, the murderers from the territories, the same two who had bungled the abduction of the boy, had blasted through a stoplight and nearly been arrested before they could return home. Things all would have been so much simpler, Sloat reflected for perhaps the thousandth time, if Phil Sawyer had never married. If no Lily, no Jack. If no Jack, no problems. Phil may never even have looked at the reports about Lily Cavanaugh's early life, Sloat had compiled. They listed where and how often and with whom, and should have killed that romance as readily as the black van turned Tommy Woodbine into a lump on the road. If Sawyer read those meticulous reports, they left him amazingly unaffected. He wanted to marry Lily Cavanaugh, and he did, as his damned twinner had married Queen Laura. More underestimation, and repaid in the same fashion, which seemed fitting. Which meant, Sloat thought with some satisfaction, that after a few details were taken care of, everything would finally be settled. After so many years, when he came back from Arcadia Beach, he should have all of Sawyer and Sloat in his pocket. And in the territories, all was placed just so, poised on the brink, ready to fall into Morgan's hands. As soon as the queen died, her consort's former deputy would rule the country, introducing all the interesting little changes both he and Sloat desired. And then watch the money roll in, Sloat thought, turning off the freeway into Marina del Rey. Then watch everything roll in. His client, Asher Dondorf, lived in the bottom half of a new condo in one of the marina's narrow, alley-like streets just off the beach. Dondorf was an old character actor who had achieved a surprising level of prominence and visibility in the late 70s through a role on a television series. He'd played the landlord of the young couple, private detectives, and both cute as baby pandas who were the series' stars. Dondorf got so much mail from his few appearances in the early episodes that the writers increased his part, making him an unofficial father to the young detectives, letting him solve a murder or two, putting him in danger, etc., etc. His salary doubled, tripled, quadrupled, and when the series was canceled after 6 years, he went back into film work. Which was the problem. Dondorf thought he was a star, but the studios and producers still considered him a character actor, popular but not a serious asset to any project. Dondorf wanted flowers in his dressing room. He wanted his own hairdresser and dialogue coach. He wanted more money, more respect, more love, more everything. Dondorf, in fact, was a putz. When he pulled his car tight into the parking bay and eased himself out, being careful not to scratch the edge of his door on the brick, Sloat came to a realization. If he learned, or even suspected, sometime in the next few days, that Jack Sawyer had discovered the existence of the territories, he would kill him. There was such a thing as an unacceptable risk. Sloat smiled to himself, popping another dye gel into his mouth, and rapped on the condo's door. He knew it already. Asher Dondorf was going to kill himself. He'd do it in the living room, in order to create as much mess as possible. A temperamental jerk like his soon-to-be ex-client would think a really sloppy suicide was revenge on the bank that held his mortgage. When a pale, trembling Dondorf opened the door, the warmth of Sloat's greeting was quite genuine. Part 2. The Road of Trials. Chapter 6. The Queen's Pavilion. The sawtoothed blades of grass directly before Jack's eyes seemed as tall and stiff as sabers. They would cut the wind, not bend to it. Jack groaned as he lifted his head. He did not possess such dignity. His stomach still felt threateningly liquid. His forehead and eyes burned. Jack pushed himself up on his knees and then forced himself to stand. A long, horse-drawn cart rumbled toward him down the dusty track, and its driver, a bearded, red-faced man, roughly the same shape and size as the wooden barrels rattling behind him, was staring at him. Jack nodded and tried to take in as much as he could about the man while giving the appearance of a loafing boy who had perhaps run off for an illicit snooze. Upright, he no longer felt ill. He felt, in fact, better than at any time since leaving Los Angeles. Not merely healthy, but somehow harmonious, mysteriously in tune with his body. The warm, drifting air of the territories patted his face with the gentlest, most fragrant of touches, its own delicate and flowery scent quite distinct beneath the stronger odor of raw meat it carried. Jack ran his hands over his face and peeked at the driver of the cart, his first sample of territory's man. If the driver addressed him, how should he answer? Did they even speak English here? His kind of English? For a moment, Jack imagined himself trying to pass unnoticed in a world where people said, "Prithee," and, "Dost thou go cross-gartered, yonder varlet?" and decided that if that was how things went, he'd pretend to be a mute. The driver finally took his eyes off Jack and clucked something decidedly not 1980s American English to his horses. But perhaps that was just the way you spoke to horses. Slusha, slusha. Jack edged backward into the seagrass, wishing that he had managed to get on his feet a couple of seconds earlier. The man glanced at him again and surprised Jack by nodding, a gesture neither friendly nor unfriendly, merely a communication between equals. "I'll be glad when this day's work is done, brother." Jack returned the nod, tried to put his hands in his pockets, and for a moment must have looked half-witted with astonishment. The driver laughed, not unpleasantly. Jack's clothes had changed. He wore coarse, voluminous woolen trousers instead of the corduroy jeans. Above the waist, a close-fitting jacket of soft blue fabric covered him. Instead of buttons, the jacket, a jerkin, he speculated, had a row of cloth hooks and eyes. Like the trousers, it was clearly handmade. The Nikes, too, were gone, replaced by flat leather sandals. The knapsack had been transmogrified into a leather sack held by a thin strap over his shoulder. The cart driver wore clothing almost exactly similar. His jerkin was of leather, stained so deeply and continuously that it showed rings within rings, like an old tree's heart. All rattle and dust, the cart pulled past Jack. The barrels radiated a yeasty musk of beer. Behind the barrel stood a triple pile of what Jack unthinkingly took to be truck tires. He smelled the tires and noticed that they were perfectly, flawlessly bald in the same moment. It was a creamy odor, full of secret depths and subtle pleasures that instantly made him hungry. Cheese, but no cheese that he had ever tasted. Behind the wheels of cheese, near the back of the cart, an irregular mound of raw meat, long, peeled-looking sides of beef, big slab-like steaks, a heap of ropey internal organs he could not identify, slithered beneath a glistening mat of flies. The powerful smell of the raw meat assailed Jack, killing the hunger evoked by the cheese. He moved into the middle of the track after the cart had passed him and watched it jounce toward the crest of a little rise. A second later, he began to follow after, walking north. He had gone only halfway up the rise when he once again saw the peak of the great tent, rigid in the midst of a rank of narrow, fluttering flags. That, he assumed, was his destination. Another few steps past the blackberry bushes where he'd paused the last time, remembering how good they'd been, Jack popped two of the enormous berries in his mouth, and he could see the whole of the tent. It was actually a big, rambling pavilion, long wings on each side with gates and a courtyard. Like the Alhambra, this eccentric structure, a summer palace, Jack's instincts told him, stood just above the ocean. Little bands of people moved through and around the great pavilion, driven by forces as powerful and invisible as the effect on iron filings of a magnet. The little groups met, divided, poured on again. Some of the men wore bright, rich-looking clothes,
though many seemed to be dressed much as Jack was. A few women in long, shining white gowns or robes marched through the courtyard as purposeful as generals. Outside the gates stood a collection of smaller tents and impromptu-looking wooden huts. Here, too, people moved, eating or buying or talking, though more easily and randomly. Somewhere down in that busy crowd, he would have to find the man with a scar. But first he looked behind him, down the length of the rutted track, to see what had happened to Fun World. When he saw two small dark horses pulling plows, perhaps 50 yards off, he thought that the amusement park had become a farm. But then he noticed the crowd watching the plowing from the top of the field, and understood that this was a contest. Next, his eye was taken by the spectacle of a huge red-haired man, stripped to the waist, whirling about like a top. His outstretched hands held some long, heavy object. The man abruptly stopped whirling and released the object, which flew a long way before it thudded and bounced on the grass and revealed itself to be a hammer. Fun World was a fair, not a farm. Jack now saw tables heaped with food, children on their father's shoulders. In the midst of the fair, making sure that every strap and harness was sound, every oven stoked with wood, was there a Speedy Parker? Jack hoped so. And was his mother still sitting by herself in the tea and jam shop, wondering why she had let him go? Jack turned back and watched the long cart rattle through the gates of the summer palace and swing off to the left, separating the people who move there, as a car making a turn off Fifth Avenue separates pedestrians on a crosstown street. A moment later, he set off after it. He had feared that all the people on the pavilion grounds would turn toward him, staring, instantly sensing his difference from them. Jack carefully kept his eyes lowered whenever he could, and imitated a boy on a complicated errand. He had been sent out to assemble a list of things. His face showed how he was concentrating to remember them. A shovel, two picks, a ball of twine, a bottle of goose grease. But gradually he became aware that none of the adults before the summer palace paid him any attention at all. They rushed or dawdled, inspected the merchandise, rugs, iron pots, bracelets displayed in the little tents, drank from wooden mugs, plucked at another's sleeve to make a comment or start a conversation, argued with the guards at the gate, each wholly taken up by his own business. Jack's impersonation was so unnecessary as to be ridiculous. He straightened up and began to work his way, moving generally in an irregular half-circle toward the gate. He had seen almost immediately that he would not be able just to stroll through it. The two guards on either side stopped and questioned nearly everyone who tried to reach the interior of the summer palace. Men had to show their papers or display badges or seals which gave them access. Jack had only Speedy Parker's fingerpick, and he didn't think that would get him past the guards' inspection. One man, just now stepping up to the gate, flashed a round silver badge and was waved through. The man following him was stopped. He argued, then the tone of his manner changed, and Jack saw that he was pleading. The guard shook his head and ordered the man off. "His men don't have any trouble getting in," someone to Jack's right said, instantly solving the problem of territory's language, and Jack turned his head to see if the man had spoken to him. But the middle-aged man walking beside him was speaking to another man, also dressed in the plain, simple clothes of most of the men and women outside the palace grounds. "They'd better not," the second man answered. "He's on his way. Supposed to be here today sometime, I guess." Jack fell in behind these two and followed them toward the gate. The guards stepped forward as the men neared, and as they both approached the same guard, the other gestured to the man nearest him. Jack hung back. He still had not seen anyone with a scar, nor had he seen any officers. The only soldiers in sight were the guards, both young and countrified. With their broad red faces above the elaborately pleated and ruffled uniforms, they looked like farmers in fancy dress. The two men Jack had been following must have passed the guards' tests, for after a few moments' conversation, the uniformed men stepped back and admitted them. One of the guards looked sharply at Jack, and Jack turned his head and stepped back. Unless he found the captain with the scar, he would never get inside the palace grounds. A group of men approached the guard who had stared at Jack and immediately began to wrangle. They had an appointment. It was crucial they be let in. Much money depended on it. Regrettably, they had no papers. The guard shook his head, scraping his chin across his uniform's white ruff. As Jack watched, still wondering how he could find the captain, the leader of the little group waved his hands in the air, pounded his fist into a palm. He had become as red-faced as the guard. At length, he began jabbing the guard with his forefinger. The guard's companion joined him. Both guards looked bored and hostile. A tall, straight man in a uniform subtly different from the guard's. It might have been the way the uniform was worn, but it looked as though it might serve in battle as well as in an operetta, noiselessly materialized beside them. He did not wear a ruff, Jack noticed a second later, and his hat was peaked instead of three-cornered. He spoke to the guards and then turned to the leader of the little group. There was no more shouting, no more finger-jabbing. The man spoke quietly. Jack saw the danger ebb out of the group. They shifted on their feet, their shoulders sank, they began to drift away. The officer watched them go, then turned back to the guards for a final word. For the moment while the officer faced in Jack's direction, in effect shooing the group of men away with his presence, Jack saw a long, pale lightning bolt of a scar zigzagging from beneath his right eye to just above his jawline. The officer nodded to the guards and stepped briskly away. Looking neither to the left nor to the right, he wove through the crowd, apparently headed for whatever lay to the side of the summer palace. Jack took off after him. "Sir!" he yelled, but the officer marched on through the slow-moving crowd. Jack ran around a group of men and women hauling a pig toward one of the little tents, shot through a gap between two other bands of people approaching the gate, and finally was close enough to the officer to reach out and touch his elbow. "Captain?" The officer wheeled around, freezing Jack where he stood. Up close, the scar seemed thick and separate, a living creature riding on the man's face. Even unscarred, Jack thought, this man's face would express a forceful impatience. "What is it, boy?" the man asked.
"Captain, I'm supposed to talk to you. I have to see the lady, but I don't think I can get into the palace. Oh, you're supposed to see this."
He dug into the roomy pocket of the unfamiliar pants and closed his fingers around a triangular object. When he displayed it on his palm, he felt shock boom through him. What he held in his hand was not a finger pick, but a long tooth, a shark's tooth, perhaps, inlaid with a winding, intricate pattern of gold. When Jack looked up at the captain's face, half expecting a blow, he saw his shock echoed there. The impatience, which had seemed so characteristic, had utterly vanished. Uncertainty and even fear momentarily distorted the man's strong features. The captain lifted his hand to Jack's, and the boy thought he meant to take the ornate tooth. He would have given it to him, but the man simply folded the boy's fingers over the object on his palm. "Follow me," he said. They went around to the side of the great pavilion, and the captain led Jack behind the shelter of a great sail-shaped flap of stiff, pale canvas. In the glowing darkness behind the flap, the soldier's face looked as though someone had drawn on it with thick pink crayon. "That sign," he said, calmly enough. "Where did you get it?"
"From Speedy Parker. He said that I should find you and show it to you."
The man shook his head. "I don't know the name. I want you to give me the sign, now. Now." He firmly grasped Jack's wrist. "Give it to me, and then tell me where you stole it."
"I'm telling the truth," Jack said. "I got it from Lester Speedy Parker. He works at Fun World. But it wasn't a tooth when he gave it to me. It was a guitar pick."
"I don't think you understand what's going to happen to you, boy."
"You know him," Jack pleaded. "He described you. He told me you were a captain of the Outer Guards. Speedy told me to find you."
The captain shook his head and gripped Jack's wrist more firmly. "Describe this man. I'm going to find out if you're lying right now, boy, so I'd make this good if I were you."
"Speedy's old," Jack said. "He used to be a musician."
He thought he saw recognition of some kind flash in the man's eyes.
He's black, a black man, with white hair, deep lines in his face, and he's pretty thin, but he's a lot stronger than he looks.
A black man? You mean a brown man?
Well, black people aren't really black, like white people aren't really white.
A brown man named Parker. The captain gently released Jack's wrist. He is called Parkus here. So you are from... He nodded toward some distant, invisible point on the horizon.
That's right, Jack said.
And Parkus... Parker sent you to see our queen.
He said he wanted me to see the lady, and that you could take me to her.